First tell me, Mr. Stephen Raven, where and when you were born.
1938.
What was the date?
19th of January. So just before the Second World War in Bromley, Kent.
And who were your parents?
Name?
Yes.
My father was Ernest Frank Raven, who was a member of the Stock Exchange. And my mother was Violet Lillian Raven, who herself at some stage had worked for the exchange in my father's firm. That's how they met.
Did any of your grandparents have connections in the city?
No. As far as I can recall, and sadly they died before I was born, they had no city involvement at all.
Was your father a stockbroker or a stock jobber?
He was a stock jobber. He started with the firm which I went into in 1955. He started in just before the First World War, I think it was something like 1914 or 1916, around that period, simply by answering an advertisement to go as the office boy. He had been working, I think, in a shop as an assistant. And his father persuaded him to answer this advertisement because he rather felt it would be useful to go to the city, which he did. And he was literally, the office boy running around delivering stock. And he liked the business. Clearly he stayed. And that was his whole career path. Mm-hmm. And he retired in 1973. Having, I think, enjoyed, nearly 60 years in the city.
Did his stock exchange career impinge much on the family life? For example, did you as a boy have much idea what he went off and did during the day?
Yes. In my teens, really, I became more aware of that. Unfortunately, during the war, he was away all of the time. He was stationed in Malta. And it wasn't until I was sort of six or seven that I even realized I had a father, let alone what he did. So I think in my early teens, I became more aware that he was involved, as they used to say, as something in the city. And we used to come up during the school holidays to visit his office. And I remember those days quite well. And I'm sitting here talking to you, looking at London Bridge, and I can well remember walking over London Bridge, from London Bridge Station, to my father's office, which was in Old Broad Street. Gresham House, Old Broad Street, which sadly no longer exists and is part of the NatWest Tower now. Well, that's where the NatWest Tower is. And I remember walking along over that bridge and seeing all the big liners tied up near Adelaide House, which I'm looking at now. And, a very thriving, busy community, the river as a working river. And I remember looking at those ships and thinking how exciting it would be one day to go on one of them and go abroad, etc. So, yes, I became aware of the city and what it meant, from the point of view of commerce as a schoolboy would understand it. And our visits during school holidays to my father's office with my mother were regular. Mm-hmm. And I got to know the staff and over the years, began to have a little bit of a feel for the business. Mm.
Did the firm provide your father with a reasonably good living?
Yes, nothing fantastic, and I don't think there was a great fantastic amount of money to be made in those days, and we're now talking of, when I was coming up, of the late 40s, early 50s. Still a very gloomy time after the war. And my father's firm specialized in foreign securities, particularly Americans and Canadians. And because of foreign exchange, which had been imposed at the time of the war, there was not an enormous amount of interest from the investor's point of view in dealing in those securities. So I think it was tough for him in those days. And we lived in a very modest house, a rented house. Father never felt that it was right to put his own capital into a house after the war. he felt that it was much better to use the capital in the firm. He was, by this time, of course, a partner, and was made a partner actually very soon after coming to the firm. Although he started as an office boy, he had this sort of ability to cope as a jobber and make prices and understand the business as a trader. And they made him a partner when he was 21, which was quite something in those days, because he didn't have the old school tie or any backing, which was still important in the early 20th century. So he literally worked his way up to a partnership very well, but never had a great deal of money to use as a capital base. So whatever he managed to make, he kept in as his partnership stake so that he could have an increased percentage, etc. So there was never a great deal of money, as I recall, as a boy, for living in a very, you know, smart home and having all the trappings that go with it. We had a modest home. We didn't have a motor car. We didn't have things like fridges or central heating, which everyone sort of takes for granted these days. We did go to private school. I have one sister who's 7 years older than me, and we did go to private school, which clearly they thought was important at the time, and I think I still believe in that myself. But apart from that, we had a very modest life. Holidays in local, holidays in English seaside resorts, going down by train, and very modest.
Would you say your parents had influenced you?
Oh, enormously. And we were a very close family and a very loving family. We had, my sister and myself, enormous respect for my parents, and they devoted their life actually to their two children. Father had very little outside interest outside of his firm and the city, and neither did mother. And so there was this family unit that developed around, I suppose, father's business, not that we were necessarily conscious of it as youngsters. And yes, they did influence, I think, both my sister and myself. My sister came up and worked for a stockbroking firm. And as I told you earlier, my mother also worked for the firm that my father was with, and that's how they met. So you could say that the stock exchange was one truly, I was born into it, if you like. Mm-hmm. So yes, there was that influence. I had an aunt, my mother's sister, worked for a stockbroking firm. So we were all involved one way or another. And this was very much the pattern. Families were involved in city firms. It was very much the trend that you would introduce your son or your daughter or your relations into your own small firms, because there were many, many firms, and they were all small family businesses of one sort or another. So yes, there was that general influence. And I was very grateful for it.
What kind of jobs did the women do in the firms? Because obviously, they weren't going onto the floor of the house.
No. Secretarial, of course. My mother and my sister became comptometer operators, if that's something which is familiar to you, which, of course, was the early calculating machine. Very tough things to work. And my mother worked on them before they became electronic comptometers. And one had to have a certain amount of force just to push the keys down. And my mother was the first female employed by what was, you know, a firm that my father was a partner in, a firm called Stock and Concannon, which was formed, if my memory serves me right, I think 1896, so, you know, in the last century. And my mother was the first female that they had employed. Maybe they didn't get on too well with females, and my father was given the job to marry her, I don't know. But anyway, they obviously struck up a relationship and married. And soon after marriage, she left the firm. But other girls at that time, I believe, were doing very much the secretarial, telephonist, keyboard work. But I was not aware of too many girls, even when I joined in 1955, even involved in the clerical side. And I don't think I knew of anyone that was a sort of a stockbroker. Certainly there wasn't anyone as a jobber, because as you rightly say, they would not have been permitted to go on the floor. And the activity of a jobber was obviously based on the floor.
Where had you gone to school?
I went to a prep school. Well, I went to several schools during the war, and I went boy with where they were, because it was wherever mother felt safe away from the bombs. So I probably went to more than I could remember. But I settled down after the war to a prep school in Bickley in Kent called Bickley Park School, which, you know, was a very fine school. I enjoyed that enormously. I then went on to a grammar school. There wasn't, well, the market was probably pretty thin in the late 40s or early 50s, so I didn't think there was enough money to send me to public school. I didn't know it at the time. So I went to St. Joseph's College, Beulah Hill, which is southeast London, which was a Roman Catholic college run by the St. John Baptist de La Salle Brothers, was the full title, a French order, which had come over here, I think, prior to the war. And it was a very fine grammar school. I was very happy there, as I was at my prep school, and I think we got a very good, sound, general education. So yes, that's where I went to school.
Had you begun to make any plans about what you'd like to do as a career?
Not until I was really taking my O-levels, which I guess was, 1955. So during 54, 55, I had developed a liking for artistic work. I was quite good at art, and I thought I would probably like to think about architecture, and I'd like to be an architect. I would like to have trained as an architect. That was my thinking at the time. And I was moderately successful at school in the exams. I got sort of 8 O-levels, which was the normal sort of O-levels, the important ones, the maths and the English and the history and geography and history and all those sort of things. And one must remember that at that time, and I'm thinking now of the summer of 1955, one had to make a few choices. In the back of one's mind, you had national service to do, which was going to be 2 years out of your life somewhere along the line. If one wanted to pursue a career which required some sort of formal training, architecture, accountancy, law, whatever, it was going to be 5 to 7 years out of your life. One could, of course, choose to go to university, stay on after A-levels and do A-levels, and then go on to university. But certainly, as I recall in my grammar school, going on from the O-level time to take O-levels, very few of the boys stayed. Only those that really wanted to pursue a particular academic career and go into something, you know, which they had very deep thoughts about, stayed. I remember in our sixth form was made up of 4 or 5 boys only, whereas the fifth form, where we were taking O-level, there was a sort of, I think, 16, 18 people in the class. So it was not an automatic trend, having taken your A-levels, to stay on for A-levels, at least when I was where I was at school. So there were these choices, and I made the choice that I would not stay on to do A-levels, probably because I didn't think I could pass them if I did stay. I would not want to pursue a university career, and I guess, again, influenced by my father. I mean, my father went to an East End school and literally did the 3 R's. I mean, there was nothing as grand as even a grammar school. So there was never the influence from father or indeed mother to pursue an academic career. So it was very much, when you get to a certain age, you go out and work. So having passed and got my 8 important O-levels, I thought I wanted to do architecture. And I went to various firms, more firms that were involved in the building business. Hillier, Park and May and Rowden, I remember, was a firm that I got a job as an apprentice to. And at the same time as doing that, I applied for an early call-up. I particularly wanted to go in the RAF, and you could apply for an early call-up, and I did so. Having spent 2 or 3 months pursuing the architecture thought, I became a little disenchanted. I wasn't sure that it was quite what I wanted to do. Maybe I wasn't in the right sort of place to pursue it, and I was going to night school at a polytechnic. And I had the feeling that this wasn't going to work, and I wanted to get the 2 years national service out of the way anyway, and then maybe I would come back to architecture or whatever. So I remember in the autumn of 1955, my father, I think somewhat persuaded by my mother, said, well, come up to the office and we'll give you a bit of pocket money, and you'll probably be in the services by the end of the year or early next year, and see how you like that. So I did. I joined Stockton and Concannon in the autumn of 1955 as the sort of odd job boy and office boy and doing whatever people wanted me to do and running stock around the city, etc. And my existence there was much longer than I had anticipated, because my early call-up, as I had hoped I was going for, didn't actually come through until January 1957. So there I was for, you know, a year and a bit, working in my father's firm, where he was the fifth partner out of five. And I liked what I found. I got very much involved in our dividend department with a nice old boy, whose name I can't remember, who took me under his wing, and he taught me how to actually handle the payment of dividends on Canadian bearer stock, which was literally, you know, taking all the certificates, which clients were not allowed to hold in those days. They had to be held either in a bank or another authorized depository, of which a member firm of the Stock Exchange was an authorized depository. And we used to have this stock. We used to collect the dividends from the companies concerned to us in bulk, and we split it down to the individual shareholders who claimed that dividend from us. So it was a fairly simple procedure. And we were what was called a marking name in those days in the city as Stockton and Concannon. And as a marking name, we paid out these dividends. Anyway, I quite enjoyed that after spending a few months in the earlier days delivering stock around the city and answering telephone and doing other odd jobs. It was something I found interesting. It was interesting discovering the names of the Canadian companies, which had meant little to me in those days, Canadian Pacific Railway and Brazil Traction, which operated more down in Brazil than it did in Canada, but it was a Canadian company, International Nickel, all those sort of companies, and seeing these very attractive bearer script coming through and putting our rubber stamp on the back and working out all the numbers and paying the dividend. There was a certain interest in what owning securities and receiving dividends and the benefit of this money, you know, was going either to the investor and, of course, the people that had bought the shares in the first place, which was going to the companies. I liked it. Anyway, an opportunity came my way in the autumn of 1956 to go onto the floor of the Stock Exchange as a blue button. I hasten to add that Stockton and Concannon were a very small firm. There were only 12 people in the firm, five partners, two blue buttons on the floor, and the rest of them were running the back office. So there were only five or six running the back office. So it was a tiny little firm. But most of the firms, I think there were about 147 jobbing firms when I joined in 55. Most of the firms were that sort of size. There weren't any huge jobbing firms, as we saw in later years. So the firms were very much run as small back offices, and floor staff, and I liken it somewhat to the services themselves, where, you know, the floor staff were very much the commissioned officers, and your non-commissioned officers may be there as well as blue button clerks, and the office staff were very much the ranks, and there was this great divide, and that actually continued through all for many years after that. And the great ambition, if you were working in the back office and you had any desire to go further, was to get onto the floor of the exchange. And you didn't only have access as what was called a blue button clerk. There were two other means of having access to the floor environment, not actually going onto the floor itself. There was something called a red button clerk, which was the clerk that manually checked the bargains that the firm had done the day before. And there was a big meeting room under the stock exchange floor where you used to go down to daily as a red button, and I was a red button for a little while, to check those bargains. And in some way, that checking floor duplicated in its environment the work of the stock exchange floor. Excuse me, because the each jobbing firm had its own particular place to in that room in the basement, and each broker knew where to go to meet that jobber to check the bargains. So there was this same atmosphere under there, and they were a like-minded bunch of youngsters and very smart. I mean, you had to go down there wearing a suit and white collar. And look very smart. You couldn't just go around as people walk around the city these days. This was your first rung on the ladder to getting involved in this commission side of the business, the floor community. And the waiters, the stock exchange employees, which were then called waiters, and up to a point there's still one or two around, were very strict. I mean, they were the sergeant majors. And if you did anything on that checking floor which they thought was inappropriate, they would be down on you like a ton of bricks. So there was a discipline and a community spirit through those red buttons, the checking the bargains, that was exciting, interesting, and one felt proud to have that position as a red button. And there was also another category of person, which I forget what we were called, but you had to wear a badge which was triangular in shape. It had a green rim with a yellow or orange interior. So it was a fairly distinctive badge, which again you wore in your buttonhole. And this was somebody who was allowed to go down to this checking floor on account day. So you were only allowed down there once a fortnight to assist your red button in passing the checks for settlement on that one day at the end of the account. And I, you know, before I was red button, I had my very, my triangle or whatever it was called, which I was equally as proud of. That must have been sometime during the mid-1956 when I was doing this other work in the office as well. So having gone through those particular two areas of the business and having had the opportunity to meet people on that checking floor that subsequently one went through one's whole stock exchange life with, because they became the blue buttons, either with the brokers or with the jobbers, and subsequently became the dealers and the partners of the future. And I still know several people in the city that I met down on those checking floors, and the companionship and the spirit of you know, working through the city all those years ago together has remained, and that was terrific.
Was there any competitiveness down in the checking room?
No, I don't think there was. There was the need to be efficient and it was somewhat historical because you were checking bargains that had been done. So there was no need to be competitive. I suppose if anything, one would want to be able to prove one's efficiency in those days. So if you were a pretty sloppy checking clerk, it was unlikely that your seniors would ever promote you to a blue button. So you had to And bear in mind, there was no mechanical way of checking. The bargains which had been struck on the floor the previous day had simply been written into a book by the jobbers and their clerks. And in the evenings, the blue buttons had written those bargains into a book, which was then used for checking that following day. So there were many mistaken bargains written in by the clerks, or the jobbers themselves had made mistakes, and people who had been investing in round amounts on a particular price subsequently changed those for checking the following day. So it would be quite often, as a checking clerk, as a jobber's checking clerk, you would get a particular broker coming up to you saying, "Will we buy 250 shares of Canadian Pacific Railway at $32? And you'd say, "Oh no, we've got selling you 200 Canadian Pacific Railways at $30. Now, you had to have a little bit of flexibility in thinking, well, no one else has come to buy that 200. It must be the right firm. They wanted 250. So you would get to the situation, okay, I will check with you unless. And that was the unless, wasn't if you came on when you got back to your office and said, "No, my dealers don't agree." So you had an element of flexibility to round up the figures or perhaps change the price slightly. If I had that bargain booked in my book at $30 for Canadian Pacific, shall we say, and yet my other bargains for Canadian Pacific, or the bargain price that day for Canadian Pacific was $50, clearly my dealer had made a mistake. So you did this checking unless. And then if you went back to your office and you then wrote down the unchecked bargains, which you gave to the blue button, who no doubt talked it through with the dealer, and you'd say, "Well, the 200 shares at $30, in fact, with Messrs. Bloggs and Co., whatever it was, I believe should have been 250 shares at $50. So I have checked unless, is that all right?" Then the dealer would come back and say, "Oh yes, absolutely, I made a mistake there, and that is correct." Or he would come back and say, no way. You go back to him and say it is 200 shares at $30. So in developing that part of the business where you had to show efficiency in checking the bargain, your seniors managed to get some kind of feel as to whether you were an idiot or whether you had some possibility of developing into a blue button and maybe one day a dealer. So not quite competitiveness as such, but in the ability to have a dialogue with the broker's red buttons, you managed to demonstrate your abilities. Shall I go on?
Yes. You said then that the next stage was the promotion to becoming a blue button.
That's right.
How did you feel about that?
Well, it was always one's ambition when you'd gone into this red button area. If you liked the business, you had an ambition to go onto the floor of the exchange. And we had two blue buttons, fairly young men, and we were not the size of firm that warranted any more blue buttons. So it was not dead man shoes, but that sort of approach to it. Unless those blue buttons either were promoted or left for some reason or other, there was a block, and you could be a red button for years. And there were some pretty old red buttons down in that checking room. Anyway, I was fortunate because one of the blue buttons that we had at Stockton at the time got a bit miffed at some of the responsibility that he was given. I'll just go as an aside here. Our senior partner, Colonel Concannon, lovely old boy, member of the Stock Exchange Council, was reputed to be the best dressed man in the city of London in his time, but was getting on. I mean, he looked about 120 to me. I suppose he may have only been in his sort of 70s. I don't know. I can't recall. But he was shuffling around the city. He was half blind, but absolutely immaculate. And he wore white spats. Now, one of the jobs the junior blue button and the two had was to ensure that the colonel's white spats were changed at lunchtime. And there were a whole lot of white spats in the office. I suppose there was some sort of cleaning arrangement that they used to go to. When I was a runner, I don't think I ever got involved in that. But anyway, there was this great box of white spats in the colonel's roll-top desk, and I remember that lovely roll-top desk in the senior partner's room. And the blue button had to ensure that there was a clean pair of white spats down for the colonel at lunchtime. And the colonel always lunched at the Gresham Club, there were several clubs in the city at that time. There was the City Club and the Gresham Club, and then the colonel chose to be a member of that club. And because the poor old chap was half blind and shuffled a bit with a stick, he really needed someone to help bring him back from the club and then change his spats. And strangely enough, the senior blue button we had at the time, who'd been doing that for some years, didn't mind doing that. And that was his job. Anyway, the senior blue button couldn't do it, or was on holiday or something, and this junior blue button, whose name I'm trying to remember, but Khan, it doesn't matter. He either was being ribbed by some of his fellow blue buttons on the floor for doing this job, but he didn't like it. And he said that if he had to continue picking up the senior partner, this lovely old man from the club, and change his spats, he would leave. And I think probably